Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. We are your hosts for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg and
Pat Schlarbaugh. Thank you for listening in. Susan Franzen is out of town, so we are filling in her regular slot. We believe that she will be back next Wednesday. We hope you'll stay with us for the next hour. We have a good show planned. Loris Olson, who has just become the chair of the Story County Board of Supervisors, is here with us.
And you'll also hear about an unusual artwork on display in the Des Moines Arts Center depicting the entire Mississippi River from the geocentric standpoint. And if you're wondering what that means, stay tuned. Pat, during this hour, you'll also be sharing an interview about CWD, an affliction that is spreading among Iowa's wild deer. But first, tell us about Eagle Day. This is a yearly spectacular event, and it is around the corner.
Yeah, but first, let's share that the membership drive is making strides forward, but still has a ways to go. Go to the website at khoifm.org and locate the membership or donate button and follow the prompts to become a member of the KHOI community of listeners or call 515-292-2878 or stop in at the station at 410 Douglas in downtown Ames and support this worthy cause. Each winter, bald eagles congregate along Iowa's rivers and streams where there is open water below the locks and dams. And due to the mild winter, the river is open and consequently eagles have not concentrated like they do normally in severe or a bit more normal winter. Yet there are always eagles, and I like to say it's easy to feel good watching eagles. They truly lift your spirits. And on January 19th and 20th, there would be the 35th Keokuk Bald Eagle Appreciation Days, and many elders, including yours truly, from conservation agencies from Illinois, Missouri, and Iowa, will share the growth of our national symbols population and measures to ensure they continue to fly freely from this generation and to the next and the next forever.
Pat, how long has Eagle Day been going on?
This will be the 35th year. It was one of my first experiences January 21st in 1985.
So this is quite a grand tradition now.
It's kind of become
a big event.
Yeah. We'll be talking more about Eagle events. There's going to be one in Des Moines on February 9th and at Sailorville February 24th. But first, I am just really interested in learning about developments with John Howe, the director of the Raptor Resource Project and connected to the world-famous Decora nesting pair of bald eagles.
Decora eagles.
Are you here, John?
I am here. Good morning, Pat.
Well, this is fantastic to hear your voice. So let's catch up a little bit about yourself and how it grew into the Decora Eagle Cam of this nesting pair for this winter.
Well, for the listeners who haven't been keeping up, I'll just give a quick update. With the Decora Eagles, that famous cam that went viral back in 2011, that Bob Anderson and the Raptor Resource Project started up, that came from the making of the movie American Eagle, and that was a nature production. So that educational tool of showing and putting the Decora Eagles and a camera up in the nest and broadcasting that publicly went viral back in 2011. And that has become an educational tool to really teach the world and a lot of students and a lot of, you know, older young students, if you want to call them that, about what goes on daily and hourly and by the minute, real time, in a bald eagle's nest. So last year was a monumental year. When that all started out back in 2007, during the making of that movie, we had a male eagle that everybody became knowledgeable about and attached to. We call them Dad Decora.
And easily recognizable.
Yeah, definitely. Bob Anderson talked about, you know, ways to identify eagles and being a falconer, and identifying peregrine falcons with the falcon recovery work that he did. That was an important thing, was to identify raptors and understand what was going on with their migration patterns and habits. And so no different with these eagles. With the older cameras, the analog cameras really weren't able to get quite the detail on the eagles. So it was more based on behavior and major characteristics of the eagles, feather type and nair structure and things like that. But there's always this suspicion, if something changed a little bit one year or the other, you know, is this the same eagle that we've got?
And eagles mate for life. They're essentially connected to the territory.
And not necessarily very, very strictly to that. There's things that happen like loss of a mate or other things that tear into that mate for life pattern that we talk about. So last year, after the two late snowstorms, after 10 years of watching Dad Decora, this famous male bald eagle, he disappeared. And we have the video showing him leaving for his roost that night, and he never showed up.
And not to return. I guess life goes on. And there were young in the nest, as I recall at the time.
Right. There were three young eaglets. I think they're just to the point where they had got starting to get their thermal down. So, you know, they had reached a developmental milestone, and they looked like they were a little bit more ready to take on that Iowa winter weather.
Right.
And it did extend further into the year, it seemed, back in 2018.
Well, in a typical sense, the male would have been supplying the food to the brood,
right,
to the three young and the female. But then in his absence, thermoregulation was so critical for those young. They were able to tolerate her absence even during the cold, blustery spring days.
Yeah,
and,
so
and move
that was
forward.
A big question.
Was, yeah, it was tense. Yeah.
Yeah, so after the search, which went on for probably about a week, including Decorah's one of the few fire departments and one of the first that had a infrared and other capability drone to do some searching, you know, even with that, we were not able to find the remains of Dad Decorah.
Well, and so let's a little bit of a fast forward. There were males then in the vicinity. There were a couple eagles that apparently the males that were kind of interested in this territory. But now in a recent development, I've learned from your exceptional website that there's a male that seems to have making his home with your famous
Pat.
Female.
So very interesting story, I guess. I think it was the day after Dad Decorah had went missing, we saw another male eagle in the area, the territory there. And actually, I think the first or second day after that, we were starting to watch a little bit more intently with his disappearance there that was hanging out up in the trees close to Mom, and they were perched there. She would never let him close to the nest, but we saw an eagle there that we knew was not Dad based on his what he was doing. So he was not allowed on the nest. That was probably the biggest thing that we noticed, was that he was not on the nest. He wasn't bringing food in.
Right.
He wasn't allowed on the nest by Mom Decorah. And we knew something was different, but it was...
And now you've got a male that is on the nest, and life
right.
is moving forward. And this is just a fantastic thing. They will be essentially egg-laying.
That's going to be coming up in late February, yeah.
So, from all appearances, the Decorah Eagle Cam has gone through a rigorous filter, if you will, of how things go in nature, and has kind of come out through the other side with a positive story and with the hope. You never know about the nesting season, but there is a hope this pair will move forward and we'll have young to enjoy here in a matter of weeks.
Yes, the last very interesting part of that story is that first male. With the detailed HD cameras that we've been watching, we have been able to take a look at detailed nair structure of the male eagles, and what we really found out was these long trips that our female eagle, Mom Decorah, was taking. She basically had hooked up with a minimum, we have documentation of three male eagles over that summer period. So right now, she is hooked up with a third male eagle, and they are doing everything that looks like successful paired-up eagle pair does before getting ready to lay eggs and raise young.
So, oh, I can't wait to see the further developments. John Howe, it's just a wonderful working relationship that you provide the KHOI community of listeners, and I really express my appreciation, respect, and honor to your project, and we'll keep our fingers crossed for 2019.
Thanks so much,
Pat. Thank you, sir.
The stones along her wrist, the sparkles on the water. She knew the wisdom of bare feet along the river. She knew the wild water in her heart pound against the shore. Give a strain and make a shiver. Give a strain and make a shiver. I dreamt she was a flicker of light floating through some driftless cloud along the bluffs where my soul begins to quiver. Singing of an unraveling age, she wrapped herself in a shroud, waiting for the rush, the new river. Waiting for the rush, the new river.
And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm one of your hosts for the hour, Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm here with Pat Schlarbaum. Thank you, Pat, for bringing us up to date on the Eagles. Fabulous story. And Loris Olson was sworn in as a Story County Supervisor in January of 2017, and this month she became the chair. And welcome back to KHOI, Loris. You've been here
Thank
before.
Thank you. I have. Fond memories.
Numerous capacities.
Yes.
So let's talk about the county. What do you see for Story County in 2019?
I see us getting off to a very robust start right away and jumping off from where we ended last year. One of the things we did last year that now is happening this week is we're installing a new audiovisual system into the boardroom. There have been lots of complaints about our audio, and the visual itself usually is okay. It still will be kind of static, but what we're hoping is that that will allow people to follow us better online.
So what this means that you're videotaping the meeting so people can watch them online?
Correct. We're still videotaping. My dream is hopefully we will figure out how to stream given the live bandwidth. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's been interesting to me to coming on that is all of the protocols that have to be in place to make sure that we're not hacked, because we retain so much information. And when I was a reporter covering the board, I would be talking to the IT person, and finally, you know, it's like I couldn't just download something, and I had to bring in, finally we worked out a new flash drive. I had to bring a new flash drive every time so I didn't introduce a virus, et cetera. And now that I'm there and I realize these levels, well, then that makes a difference on the bandwidth we use and what kind of equipment. I'm excited about the new audio visual, I know, in the great scheme of things. Another thing that's going to be coming up this year that the discussion started last year, and this is not only countywide, but involves ISU and the city of Ames, and that is the new interoperability communication systems among responders. I know it's a big little title there. Right now, all of our first responders and our emergency personnel in our law enforcement, they can't easily talk to each other. They're on different systems. Some of the equipment is very, very old. And in fact, the equipment's so old we can't get replacement parts in some of them anymore. And we're talking about all the way from ISU's public safety to, of course, City of Ames, the fire department, the police, and then you come over to the sheriff's department, but also it's all of your volunteer fire departments, and it's your volunteer EMS people. There's an initiative at the state to get up more towers and try to get interoperability, and now the county, ISU, and the city have actually formed a 28E, which is the official contractual way that we would interact. And we are looking at a system right now. The two companies that bid on it are trying to work with our contractor to try to determine who will be selected. We were hoping it would be a $10 million bill. Ouch. And the quotes we got back are $13 million to start with. So they're working on trying to get that down. But we have places out in the county right now where the first responders are talking to each other by cell phones because their radios don't work or their blockages. So that's going to be a big project coming on. Watersheds are going to be a huge discussion for us this year. Last year, the county, we paid a consultant to come in and do an evaluation of each of our what are called HUC 12s. They're the smaller ones. So Squaw Creek Watershed, which you hear about sometimes, and also the South Skunk Watershed, which we formed agencies to deal with, but they are 10s. And the higher you go, the smaller the watershed, okay, the smaller the area. So we paid to get all of them evaluated. We've discovered we don't have data on all of them. But this year, we're going to start implementing, discussing, how are we going to deal now with the watersheds? Now that we have the baseline information and which ones have been monitored, now what do we do? So one of the things I think at some point we'll be coming back to the public will be to find out if there would be some more public who would be interested in monitoring, helping us gather some of that data, just like there are monitors on the Squaw Creek watershed right now.
When you say, what do we do with the watersheds, what does one do? And I mean, what kind of actions are you talking about?
We need to determine what mitigation strategies, if they are in fact impaired, what do we want to do with interacting with the farmers who may not be using cover crops? So some of that would be the mitigation to try and help clean it up.
So you're talking about the cleanliness of the water.
The cleanliness of the water, mm-hmm. Also. Also related to that is last year that our planning and zoning department, planning and development department, started working on a new stormwater ordinance for development in the rural parts of the county. And we expect that to come forward to us as the supervisors within the first quarter. Mm-hmm. Another issue that we're going to be taking a look at very, very quickly is that at the end of the year, we had three applications for confined animal feeding operations that came forward. And that was in December. And now there, it looks like we discussed yesterday that we'll be putting a possible appeal of that to the DNR for discussion. It'll be on the agenda on next Tuesday. But I think an even bigger item than that is every year we have to, as a county, every county decides whether they want to use the scoring system fondly called, or not fondly called, the Master Matrix.
The infamous Master Matrix.
And there are many people who feel it's very slanted toward the producers right now and the integrators. Mm-hmm. Well, we get every year many members of the public who come to comment on that or send information. And we learned in December, given the large crowd that turned out for the three Henry applications, sorry, Longview Pork is that the actual name of the family's company. And now decided that it was time that we have a more robust conversation on that. That is also in addition to Supervisor Linda Merkin coming on board, and she would like us to take a look at sending a letter to the state or a moratorium resolution, or there's all kinds of different things that we can do to go on the record, as have about 22 or 23 other counties. And that's something I never brought up because I knew there wasn't an appetite with the other two supervisors. And sometimes you learn about where to dedicate your staff's time, and it starts with the supervisors voting, at least two of us, right, to say we're going to spend some time and resources that way.
So the CAFO story isn't completely over yet. You're continuing a discussion about it.
We're continuing a discussion about it. Supervisor Merkin had been asked by some citizens about a possible appeal, and we're going through the steps to bring that to a discussion at the board on the 15th and allow some public input. People are going to find out that despite my past as a journalist and my very vigorous advocacy for letting every citizen speak, that probably there will be some limits about how long people can talk and how broad that topic can go, because we'll have this special meeting on January 22nd in the evening at Gates Hall.
And that'll be a public meeting.
That one will, yes, both are public meetings, but as far as the discussion.
For public comment.
For public comment, that the one that will be that Tuesday night at Gates Hall will be to discuss the philosophy and not focused on any one entity about what does the county want to weigh in on, what kind of stance do we want to take, what are the pros and the cons. And so, we expect a lot of the confinement owners to be there also. And
to speak up.
I'll be working, I believe, with both groups who would like to see a very, you know, the moratorium, et cetera, and the local Farm Bureau organization to see that that's a good orderly meeting, that people get to express themselves without a fear of either being harassed or anything. The meeting on the 15th will be very limited as far as focused on, do we want to appeal or not? The
so, Loris, you mentioned that one of the reasons you're pursuing this is because there's been a change in the voting on this County Board of Supervisors.
Correct.
And with you and Linda there, there's... My question is, do you see a shift in the County Board of Supervisors? Does this year see a change in the outlook or the way the supervisors is going to be viewing the county?
All three of the supervisors that are on the board now believe in doing the best, and I think county growth. I mean, that we are a progressive county. We are fortunate that we have enough tax revenue, but it's a situation we always have to look at growth going on. What will change is I think, the conversation as far as what constitutes good economic growth. What type of return should you get from that? What constitutes quality of life? There's a lot of interaction between the two of them. A lot of discussion. I will be sitting on the Ames Economic Development Commission now, and that's a position that Supervisor Sanders had held for about 5 years. And with that comes a seat on the executive committee of the Ames Economic Development Commission.
So, you know, defining growth is a goal that's universal to everybody. What's going to be different this time?
Well, for me personally, and one of my priorities all along has been housing. We call it affordable housing, but we actually have two needs. One is for really low and moderate income people, providing housing for people who are making very low wages or are living on kind of fixed incomes. But there's a whole nother strata out there now that has to do with what I think people my age, being a little bit older, call starter housing. It's that small square footage, maybe 900 square feet to 1,000 square feet that people used to get into when they first started out their careers. And we have a lack of that. And certainly in Ames, and I don't know that we can fix a lot of it in Ames because of how landlocked it is as far as available within the city limits. And the growth that is happening, those housing starts are at $300,000. I don't know about the listeners out there, but I don't live in a $300,000 house. So we know that there's that. But so then we're talking about pushing out into the communities like Nevada and Huxley and Story City, all of who are starting to see interest in doing housing. There's also growth as in the accommodating of the workforce. As you've read over and over again, our unemployment rate is so low. And now there's a push, an effort, a combination between United Way and the county and also the chamber to figure out how to remove some barriers from people who have historically not had access to jobs. People don't think about us as being a manufacturing sector, but we do have significant manufacturers that are paying to start $18 and $19 an hour. And now they're really approaching, whether it be DMAC or, you know, through United Way, they need training programs because they are much more willing to hire someone who doesn't have that perfect look at resume with 3 seconds, you know, that normally happens and they flip it over. They're willing to train. And an example is EB up in Story City. They need to add 64 employees for their expansion. 40 of them need to be welders. You can't find 40 unemployed welders in central Iowa.
That's
so
right.
DMAC's going to come in and train them. Mm-hmm. So that's growth also. Mm-hmm. And so how do we accommodate that growth? I don't want to say easy, so because everybody down at the ISU Research Park would say, how would he mean? This, nothing's easy to get companies to come here. But we have some real benefits. Iowa State, and it is the ag sector. How do we even integrate that ag sector with the reality of some of the issues we're facing in agriculture? So yes, so there will be different conversations than there have been at the past. It's quite likely that we will end up in the same place on some of these.
Mm-hmm. So, thank you, Laura. So we're just in the last few minutes
sure.
here. You used to be a reporter.
Yes.
You used to report a lot on government. Is it different running government than reporting on it?
Incredibly different. And most people felt I was pretty well prepared coming in. But when you get internally, you see how many different departments might have to be consulted that you never see when you're sitting out there and you're doing the reporting. You're reporting pretty much on the back end. It also is the interaction between the various levels of government, the funding. Once again, you write about how something's going to be paid for and from what fund, but you have no concept about what goes in behind the scenes. The other thing is I mean, I had covered government for 2 decades. And I always knew that government employees were not the cliche that everybody talks about, that the vast majority show up and they want to do a good job and they're working for government anymore. It's not the same what people used to call a sweet deal, right? Okay.
Oh, it's public service.
It's public service. And you put up with some people who are not happy. You deal with budget constraints and all of that. And I constantly am amazed by what public servants do that we don't think about on that. So I have really learned a new level for them.
It's amazing, right?
Well, it is.
Yeah. Well, Loris, we're kind of running out of
sure.
time, but just for those, I think most people, you've lived in the central Iowa area for quite a while.
Right.
But just for those people that don't know you, just give like a 2-minute synopsis.
Sure.
Who are you?
I'm an Iowa native. I was born in Mason City. I went to Valley High School in West Des Moines. That makes me a Valley girl. And so my first career was mortgage banking. And I worked for Norwest in the days when they weren't doing that type of thing, becoming Wells Fargo. And then I went back to school at 31 for journalism. And I worked for 2 decades in journalism. I got up here via my second stint in the Des Moines Register when they had a weekly section. And I am married to a physics professor. I have no children that have 2 legs. I have 4 that have 4 legs. Okay. I'm known for being very robust for open government, which is not just transparency, but I want the public involved from the very start.
Mm-hmm. And for the record, you were the only dissenting vote for the CAFOs.
Correct.
At the recent hearing.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yes.
Loris Olson was sworn in this month as chair of the Story County Board of Supervisors, and she's been a Story County supervisor since 2017, right?
Correct.
Thank you for joining us, and you'll come back?
I will.
Okay.
It's nice to be back with the quilts. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Loris.
I read the natives name this river for the wild onions that stunk up the mouth. You know what I'm talking about. Not so many now, but we dig our own nails in the soily banks, harvest in the spring. The lime green spring. The lime green spring.
Skunk River Song, and this is Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio. I am one of your hosts for the hour, Pat Schlarbaum, and I'm here with Ursula Rudenberg. In the 21st century, there is a disease that has been in states all around Iowa that impacts white-tailed deer. Chronic wasting disease has reared its ugly head here in Iowa, and currently wildlife professionals are committed to monitoring this disease. And let's learn more from Department of Natural Resources biologist Tyler Harms, who lives here in Ames. Thank you for coming in, Tyler.
It was my pleasure, Pat. Happy to be here.
For our listener, could you please kind of give us your impression of what people need to know about CWD and what it is?
Sure. So chronic wasting disease is a disease of the cervid family. So we're talking about deer and elk. And it was first found in the Midwest in the early 2000s in Wisconsin. So it's been around in Wisconsin for a number of years now. Found in Iowa in wild deer for the first time in the year 2013.
If we could you back up to where was CWD first diagnosed?
Sure.
Detected?
First found in the late 60s in Colorado. So it's been out west for, you know, going on 50 years now. And there are a number of other comparable diseases. So chronic wasting disease is what's called a prion disease. A prion is a misfolded protein. So it's a naturally occurring protein in bodily systems, so to speak, that just misfolds that causes this disease. And there are a number of comparable diseases in other animals as well. So mad cow would be an example in cattle, scrapie in sheep. There's actually a human prion disease called Creutzfeldt-Jakob syndrome. So not necessarily unique to deer. Prion diseases are found in other animals as well.
So I point out right off that it has not been detected of transferring from deer to humans.
That's correct.
At this time.
That's correct. Yeah, there's no, you know, that's one of the things that we talk a lot about with our deer hunters that are out there harvesting our deer now that we have chronic wasting disease and wild deer in the state is that there's currently no risk to our hunters in consuming the meat. However, that said, we're constantly learning more with the science, and so the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention actually highly recommends that hunters get their meat tested prior to consumption, and that if that the harvest animal does test positive, they strongly recommend that the meat from that animal not be consumed.
The disease, I understand, is like 100% fatal.
It is indeed, yeah. It's once a deer has it, it's 100% fatal. The other kind of scary thing, I guess, that makes it challenging for us as biologists to track this disease is that it takes about 2 years for physical symptoms to manifest themselves in deer that have this disease. And when those symptoms do show up, the deer basically looks sick. And we know that deer get sick for lots of different reasons. You know, they start to look like they're not eating well. You know, they start to behave a little bit more erratically. And those symptoms are symptoms that could be caused by a number of different illnesses that deer have. And so it makes it very challenging for us to diagnose this disease based on physical symptoms alone. And so when sometimes we'll get calls or inquiries from folks, well, I have this sick deer in my backyard. Is it chronic wasting disease? And, you know, oftentimes it's very challenging for us to know that without actually testing the animal for the disease. And unfortunately, right now, the most effective way to do that is to dispatch the animal and pull tissue from that animal.
So apparently 2013 was a cornerstone year for CWD here in Iowa.
That's right, Pat. That was the first year that we found CWD in wild or free-ranging deer. And that was in Alma Key County in northeast Iowa, which was not too surprising to us because we knew that the disease was just across the river in Wisconsin.
And deer do swim the river.
They do indeed, yeah. And, you know, there are islands on the river, too, that aid in that movement across. And so first found in Alma Key County, found in Clayton County, just south of Alma Key County a couple years later. And then now just last year, we had one deer test positive in southeast Wayne County, which is south central Iowa, right around the town of Seymour. So 28 deer total, wild deer that we've had tested positive for the disease in Iowa. 25 of those have been up in Alma Key County, two of those in Clayton County, and then the one last year in Wayne County. The results are still out this year. We're kind of nearing the end of the deer hunting season here. We've been working hard. Staff have been working really hard throughout the state in collecting samples, and we've to see solid results from those samples as to whether or not we have additional positive deer that have shown up in the state from our harvest this year. It's very likely, particularly in the northeast part of the state now, where we have a number of deer that will have more positives show up. And again, that's not too surprising.
And how was the sampling proceeding to come to the point where it was detected in Iowa?
Sure, that's a great question, Pat. And so, you know, we've known now for a long time that it's been in Wisconsin. And so knowing that, we increased our sampling efforts in the northeast part of the state. And now I should back up and say, so our sampling efforts have kind of evolved over the years in terms of how we sample deer and how they get tested for this disease. Right now, what we do is pull what are called the retropharyngeal lymph nodes. And so if you think about if you ever get sick and you feel the lymph nodes starting to swell up in your neck, those are basically the lymph nodes that we're pulling out of the deer. And we send those into a lab, and those get tested for the disease. So now that we know a little bit about the sampling, I'll go on to talk about how we sample. And so knowing that it was in Wisconsin, we increased our sampling efforts in that part of the state. And then we also sample throughout the state in more of a, what I would call more of a surveillance effort, where we know that the threat is lower, say, in central Iowa, for example, because we're not on the border of a state that has the disease. But we still want to collect samples in those parts of the state to continue to ensure that we don't have it. And so we have some different types of efforts where we have increased sampling in priority areas like northeast Iowa, and then we have kind of a minimal level of sampling everywhere in the state, lower priority areas, to just make sure that we don't have sparks, so to speak, pop up in other areas
of
the state.
And as the biometrician for the Department of Natural Resources, statistics is a pretty solid cornerstone of your profession. So when you mention the sampling, is there a certain percentage of the herd, the deer population in general, that you're targeting to try and get some grasp on what might be occurring in nature?
There is. Yeah, you're right, Pat. I'm glad you brought that up. And so as a statistician, of course, I'm always going to say, let's collect as many samples as we can, right? Because I want more samples is better from our point of view. But logistically, that's, you know, obviously very challenging. We can't sample every deer that gets harvested in Iowa because we harvest 100,000 deer every year in the state. And so we try to do our best at getting a proportion of the herd in certain areas. We estimate abundance of deer in certain areas, usually based on the annual harvest. We know that the annual harvest is a pretty good index to population levels in areas, and we use that information to try to get an idea of how many deer there are in a priority area, for example. And then the other two important components to determine how many samples we need is we have to make a decision on how confident we want to be, a confidence level, that we detect the disease. That might be 75%. That might be 85%. It could be 99%. But that's going to impact how many samples we collect. And so that's kind of where the balance comes, is determining the trade-off between logistics and statistics. I always say the two words that sound very similar. We want to be as confident as possible, realizing that, you know, we're constrained logistically on how many samples we can collect. So that's one of the things we consider, too, in addition to population abundance.
So this topic is not new to the nation. has become relevant here in Iowa. I might point out that vision administrator Dr. Dale Garner studied diseases of moose. So there's people on staff in the Department of Natural Resources that have a pretty firm grasp on wildlife diseases and these 21st century challenges. And it sounds like with your background as a biologist and then with that special niche of statistics that you're kind of a man of the times here, and a lot of weight on your shoulders. How does that feel as a young man, a graduate from Iowa State?
Well, I tell you, it's a big weight. I'd be a liar if I said that I don't enjoy the challenge. It's always been my dream to work to better the natural resources and the wildlife resources in the state of Iowa. I grew up in north central Iowa, and so I really do enjoy the challenge. And this disease, being that it's 100% fatal, and it seems like, at least as of right now, it tends to be a bit challenged to manage. It can be somewhat depressing sometimes when we think about what we need to do or what we can do currently to manage this disease to ensure that we have a sustainable white-tailed deer herd for the future. You know, I think the key is to remain positive. There are a lot of great researchers and great studies out there that are gathering more and more information for us on how to manage this disease effectively, what we can do about it. And so the science is intriguing, and it's a good thing to keep us positive because we're constantly learning more about this disease.
To the Iowa landscape, there are the game farms, the areas with the big fences, and the deer are somewhat controlled. And you mentioned the positive perspective that we need to maintain. What is the motivation to set up a deer hunting area with a big fence where only those deer can be harvested? Does that fit into this as a challenge for the 21st century?
Well, it certainly could be a challenge. We know that their movements are altered in those situations. Their natural movements are altered by fences. We also know that deer are moved among different farms on the landscape, and so we have a number of different artificial movements happening in these situations. And whenever we introduce artificial movements or anything artificial into a natural system, to change the game a little bit. And so, another good example of an artificial addition to a natural system would be mineral licks or salt blocks that people put out on a landscape, or just bait in general. You know, it's an artificial addition to the landscape. And although we can't necessarily point the finger as that being a cause for spread of CWD, what we do know is that CWD is spread by direct contact. And we also know that those bait piles or mineral licks artificially congregate deer in an area. And a colleague of mine in the DNR always uses the infected soup bowl example. So if you, Pat, had the flu and you were drinking from a soup bowl and you passed that soup bowl around to me and a number of others here in the studio and we all drank from that soup bowl, chances are we're all probably going to get the flu, right? And so so that artificial congregation is a bit problematic, and especially from a disease standpoint.
And there are concentrations of deer in the game preserves that might exceed what was happening in previous landscape. And then there's movement. They sell deer. Deer go up and down the interstate highway systems now. How does that factor into the CWD spread?
Well, like I said before, it's an artificial movement. We know that deer can move some pretty amazing distances on their own based on some of the movement studies that are ongoing in the Midwest. But, you know, moving a deer from central Iowa to central South Dakota, a deer probably isn't going to move that far on its own. And if that deer just so happened to have chronic wasting disease, now you're introducing that deer into a new landscape. That can be problematic. There are definitely some challenges there, and I think it's, as people, we always want to try to point fingers at somebody or something or some factor that might be leading to a particular issue. What we're trying to do in the DNR is to, you know, we're definitely not going to point fingers because it's hard to do that. What we want to do is to try to focus our efforts on learning more about what we can do to manage this disease on the landscape, because that's going to be the sustainable effort moving forward, and the sustainable outcome is trying to figure out, working together with all of our constituents, our deer hunters, and everyone else, the Iowa citizens, to try to determine what the best course of action is for managing this disease.
And I might point out that deer check stations have been implemented in other states. In Iowa, we really haven't gone in that requirement, but there are means to assist in getting each deer tested. And for the listeners who don't realize, when you get your deer tag, there's a reporting system that helps determine the scale of the population in certain locales. And the number that is recorded when you report your deer, and then with the sample, they can get right back to you. So that has now been linked with the statistics. That's probably a big part of your job, is making sure that people, when they report their deer, well, and then if they provide the sample, then they can learn the status of their deer in pretty short order time.
Yeah, that's right. We're very excited about that new development this year with the online system, allowing hunters to obtain the test results from their deer. It's good information for them, and obviously it's really important information for us for tracking the spread of the disease.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else? We certainly have a resource, considerable abundance. One of the things that it does occur in areas where deer have been diagnosed with CWD, is there attempts then to have extra doe tags or a way to suppress that population?
That is certainly one of the strategies, and it's one of the strategies that we're employing right now in Iowa for a number of reasons. Our mission right now is to essentially slow the spread of chronic wasting disease in the state until we have more scientific information on what we can do to manage the disease in the population. Like I mentioned before, Pat, we're constantly learning more about this disease, and so that's the good thing. And then, yes, we do have the ability to allow additional antlerless licenses in those areas to try to increase harvest for a couple of reasons. One, obviously, we know that reducing densities is going to help in slowing the spread of the disease. But we also know that increased harvest also allows us to collect more samples if hunters are willing to cooperate with us in submitting tissue samples. And again, the more samples we get, the better we can learn about how this disease is spreading on the landscape. And so that's how we're moving forward currently. As we learn more, that may or may not change. We'll see. If folks have more questions, they can learn more on our website, www.iowadnr.gov/CWD. If you go to /hunting or /deer, any of those things, you'll find information on chronic wasting disease on our website. So certainly encourage folks to visit our website, learn more about the disease if you're interested, particularly deer hunters in those targeted areas, Alamakee, Clayton, and Wayne County. You can find some great information on both what we're doing to learn more about the disease and to manage the disease in Iowa, but also what we already do know based on science that's been conducted elsewhere.
Certainly a pleasure having your solid biological voice in some concerns of southern Iowa and what's happening up in northeast Iowa. Good luck in your mission of controlling the spread of the chronic wasting disease here in Iowa, deer. Thank you, Tyler Harms, with the Iowa Department of Natural Resource research biologist at the Wildlife Research Station just south of Boone on the Des Moines River.
This has been great, Pat. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tyler.
My pleasure.
And thank you, Pat, for bringing us that interview. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. During the last few minutes of the show, artist and poet Jen Bervin is on the phone with us from Connecticut. Jen is a native Iowan. She's from Dubuque, and her parents live in Ames. And her work is currently on display at the Des Moines Arts Center. The work is called River. It maps the Mississippi from the headwaters in Lake Itasca, Minnesota, to its delta south of New Orleans in Louisiana. And the Mississippi River is presented on the ceiling of the IMP Gallery from a geocentric perspective. And we'll get back to that in a minute. Hello, Jen. Are you there?
Hi.
Hi, Jen. Thanks.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for joining us. So explain exactly what your artwork is.
Okay. It's a piece that spans the ceiling of the IMP Gallery, and it's a hand-sewn scale model of the Mississippi River. The materials of the piece are silver sequins, and they're sewn onto a substrate of other materials, and they trace the architecture of that space. It's a very large piece. It's about two-thirds of a football field long in curvilinear length, and I have to say that it's very exciting to have it up at the Des Moines Arts Center for the very first time because I've never seen what I have been making all these years.
So this is a premiere of the exhibit.
It is. It is.
And will this exhibit travel, or is this one-time show?
Well, this is the premiere, and piece will travel. We don't have the next venue for it, but I'm really happy that Des Moines was able to present it first. Like you said, I was born in Iowa, and I really feel like my connection to the river starts in this state, and it's important to share it here first.
So what exactly is a geocentric perspective?
So if you can imagine, if you're standing in the Iron Pay Gallery, your position as a viewer is inside the earth looking up at the riverbed. So it's an imagined perspective.
So you're standing in the center of the earth?
Yes.
And you're looking up?
Yes.
And how does that affect how it looks?
Essentially, it looks pretty similar, but it's mirrored. So if you're trying to find, for example, the place that you grew up on the river, whether it's Memphis or Dubuque, it's backwards. So it takes longer to find your sense of place. It slows you down and makes you look differently.
And why did you choose that perspective?
It's a complicated question to answer in a certain way, in part because I wanted to offer a perspective that we don't have and a perspective that will slow us down. I think that there's a relationship in this piece to time, and especially to geological time, that's important. The river, as we now know it, is only about 35,000 years old, and you can really see the alluvial history in the lower river, in the Meander Belt in particular. And there's also the relationship of making time. So it took me about the same amount of time to sew each section of the river that it would have taken to walk it.
The scale of the river is 1 inch to 1 mile, is that correct?
It is, it is. The river is kind of this thin, meandering silver line throughout the space, and then the delta is done a little bit differently. Same materials, hand-sewn sequins, but the archipelagos in the delta are mirrored. So wherever the piece is shown, the people and the space that it's shown in will be reflected in the piece.
Now, you mentioned earlier that it was nice to see the work after working on it so long. How long did it take you to make this piece?
I made it over the course of 12 years.
Wow, you've been on this for 12 years.
Yeah. And I should say I worked on a lot of other things during that time, but yeah, 12 years.
Let's talk about the river just for a minute. What have you heard from other people who look at this piece? What have they been telling you about the Mississippi River? This is something as Iowans that we all share, is this beautiful river.
Well, I think that one thing that's been really wonderful in Des Moines is that it's become a kind of a site for storytelling. And my primary experience there was with the museum staff and also a lot of the kids who visit. It's a very full museum, full of sound, full of people. And so you hear a lot. It's not a kind of quiet, solemn space at all. And some of my favorite conversations were with some of the museum guards, in particular one who grew up on the river, shared some stories that were very, very powerful stories. And
can you give us an example?
I feel they're his stories to share, so I don't feel like they're, they're mine to convey. But I encourage viewers to go there and also to listen, to look at the piece, but also to listen to other people in that space and ask them questions. It's ideally a space for further questioning and a process of looking and understanding.
Okay, well, we are out of time. It'd be great to talk a little bit longer, but we do have to end the show, and we've been speaking with Jen Bervin, who's an artist and poet, and whose work is called River, displaying at the Des Moines Art Gallery. And it's there until January 27th, right?
It is. The Des Moines Art Center is free, open to the public. There are fantastic programs for people of all ages, and they have an excellent docent program. So if you want to talk with someone about the piece, there are about 40 extremely well-informed docents who can have a conversation with you.
Okay, and your last word on the Mississippi River?
It's for you.
Okay.
It's for you at this point.
This is Pat, and I can't wait to see your art.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you,
Jen.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've been your hosts, Ursula Rudenberg and Pat Schlarbaum. Thank you for listening.
Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also remember that you can hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Also remember that KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard Rush of the New River by John Strawber's Big Blue Sky Band and Skunk River Song by Lindsay Nissen.
We are about $400 short of raising $30,000 for KHOI operations, so if you haven't donated to KHOI, how about now? Mm-hmm. This would be a great time. You can be the one who gets our winter fund drive across the finish line at $30,000, and you can donate safely online at khoifm.org, or you can send a check or just stop by. The door is open. Find our address on Douglas Avenue downtown on our website, khoifm.org. Today's show was engineered by Aladdin Alkathiri. Thank you, Aladdin. Stay tuned for Headline News and Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m.
And thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.